and then it gives my editor a week to edit it, and then it comes to you guys. So, if you want to, you know, keep up and be a whole chapter ahead of everyone else, as I always say, come join the Discord and give your input into the story, the character voices, the emotions that are supposed to be betrayed. Let me know if I make any mistakes. Very helpful in the live runs. Thank you so much for listening so far, and see you next week. Chapter 37. Interlude. Crossing the boundary. It was almost midnight. Staying up late was simple enough for Harry. He just hadn't used the time turner. Harry followed a tradition of timing his sleep cycle to make sure he was awake for when Christmas Eve turned into Christmas Day. Because, while he'd never been young enough to believe in Santa Claus, he'd once been young enough to doubt. It would have been nice if there had been a mysterious figure who'd entered your house in the night and brought you presents. A chill went down Harry's spine then, an intimation of something dreadful approaching. A creeping terror. A sense of doom. Harry sat bolt upright in bed. He looked at the window.
"Professor Quirrell!"
Harry shrieked very quietly. Professor Quirrell made a slight lifting gesture, and Harry's window seemed to fold into its frame. At once, a cold gust of winter blew into the room through the gap, along with a scant few flakes of snow from a sky spotted with grey night clouds amid the black and stars.
"Fear not, Mr. Potter," said the defence professor in a normal voice. "I have charmed your parents asleep. They shall not wake until I have departed."
"No one's supposed to know where I am," said Harry, still keeping the shriek quiet. "Even owls are supposed to deliver my mail to Hogwarts, not here."
Harry had agreed to that willingly. It would be silly if a Death Eater could win the whole war at any time just by owling him a magically triggered hand grenade. Professor Quirrell was grinning from where he stood in the backyard beyond the window.
"Oh, I shouldn't worry, Mr. Potter. You are well protected against locating charms, and no blood purist is likely to think of consulting a phone book." His grin grew wider. "And it did take considerable effort to cross the wards that the headmaster put around this house. Though, of course, anyone who knew your address could simply wait outside and attack you the next time you left."
Harry stared at Professor Quirrell for a while.
"What are you doing here?"
Harry said finally. The smile left Professor Quirrell's face.
"I've come to apologize, Mr. Potter," the defense professor said quietly. "I should not have spoken to you so harshly as I..."
"Don't,"
Harry said. He looked down at the blanket that he was clutching around his pajamas.
"Just don't."
"Have I offended you that much?"
said Professor Quirrell's quiet voice.
"No,"
Harry said.
"But you will if you apologize."
"I see,"
said Professor Quirrell, and in an instant his voice grew stern.
"Then, if I am to treat you as an equal, Mr. Potter, I should say that you have gravely violated the etiquette that holds between friendly Slytherins. If you are not currently playing the game against someone, you must not meddle in their plans like that, not without asking them before. For you do not know what their true design may be, nor what stakes they may lose. It would mark you as their enemy, Mr. Potter.
I'm sorry,
Harry said in just the same quiet tone that Professor Quirrell had used.
Apology accepted, said Professor Quirrell.
But,
Harry said, still quietly,
you and I really must speak further on politics at some point.
Professor Quirrell sighed.
Ah, I know you dislike condescension, Mr. Potter.
That was a bit of an understatement.
But it would be even more condescending, said Professor Quirrell, if I were not to state it clearly. You are missing some life experience, Mr. Potter.
And does everyone who has sufficient life experience agree with you, then?
Said Harry calmly.
What good is life experience to someone who plays Quidditch?
Said Professor Quirrell, and shrugged.
I think you will change your mind in time. After every trust you place has failed you, and you have become cynical.
The defense professor said it as though it were the most ordinary statement in the world, framed against the black and the stars and the cloud-spotted sky as one or two tiny snowflakes blew past him in the biting winter air.
That reminds me, said Harry. Merry Christmas.
I suppose, said Professor Quirrell.
After all, if it is not an apology, then it must be a Christmas gift. The very first one I have ever given, in fact.
Harry hadn't even started yet on learning Latin, so he could read the experimental diary of Roger Bacon, and he hardly dared to open his mouth to ask.
Put on your winter coat, said Professor Quirrell, or take a warming potion if you have one, and meet me outside under the stars. I shall see if I can maintain it a little longer this time.
It took Harry a moment to process the words, and then he was dashing for the coat closet. Professor Quirrell kept the spell of starlight going for more than an hour, though the defense professor's face grew strained and he had to sit down after a while. Harry protested only once, and was shushed. They crossed the boundary from Christmas Eve to Christmas Day within that timeless void where earthly rotations meant nothing. The one true, everlasting, silent night. And, just as promised, Harry's parents slept soundly all through it, until Harry was safely back in his room, and the defense professor had gone. Chapter 38. The Cardinal's Sin. Bright the sun, bright the air, bright the students and bright their parents, clean the paved ground of platform 9.75. The winter sun, hanging low in the sky at 9:45 a.m. in the morning on January 5th, 1992. Some of the younger students wore scarves and mittens, but most simply wore their robes. They were wizards, after all. After Harry had moved away from the landing platform, he took off his scarf and coat, opened a compartment of his trunk, and stowed away his winter things. For a long moment he stood there, letting the January air bite at him, just to see what it was like. Harry took out his wizard's robes, shrugged them on, and, finally, Harry drew his wand. And he couldn't help thinking of the parents he'd only just kissed goodbye, of the world whose problems he was leaving behind. With a strange feeling of guilt for the unavoidable, Harry said,
Thermos!
The warmth
flowed through him. And the boy who lived was back. Harry yawned and stretched, feeling more lethargic than anything else at the conclusion of his vacation. He didn't feel like reading his textbooks or even any serious science fiction this morning. What he needed was something completely frivolous to occupy his attention. Well, that wouldn't be hard to come by, if he was willing to part with fork nuts. Besides, if the Daily Prophet was corrupt and the Quibbler was the only competing newspaper, there might be some suppressed real news in there. Harry trudged back over to the same newsstand from last time, wondering if the Quibbler could top the headline he'd seen before. The vendor started to smile as Harry approached, and then the man's face suddenly changed as he caught sight of the scar.
"Harry Potter?" gasped the vendor. "No, Mr. Durian," said Harry, eyes dipping briefly to the man's name tag. "Just an amazing imitation."
And then Harry's voice stopped in his throat as he caught sight of the top fold of the Quibbler.
"Sloshed Seer spills secrets. Dark Lord to return."
For just an instant, Harry tried to clamp down on his face, before realizing that not being shocked could be just as revealing, in a sense.
"Excuse me," Harry said.
His voice sounded a little alarmed, and he didn't even know whether that was too revealing or just what his normal reaction would be if he didn't know anything. He spent too much time around Slytherins. He was forgetting how to keep secrets from ordinary people. Four knuts hit the counter.
"One copy of the Quibbler, please."
"Oh, no worries, Mr. Potter," said the vendor hastily, waving his hands. "It's... never mind. Just..."
A newspaper flew through the air and hit Harry's fingers, and he unfolded it.
"Sloshed Seer spills secrets. Dark Lord to return. Wed Draco Malfoy."
"It's free," said the vendor. "For you, I mean."
"No," Harry said. "I was going to buy one anyway."
The vendor took the coins and Harry read on.
"Gosh," Harry said half a minute later. "You get a seer smashed on 6 slugs of scotch and she spills all sorts of secret stuff. I mean, who'd have thought that Sirius Black and Peter Pettigrew were secretly the same person?"
"Not me," said the vendor.
"They've even got a picture of the two of them together, so we know who it is that's secretly the same person."
"Yep," said the vendor. "Pretty clever disguise, isn't it?
And I'm secretly 65 years old."
"You don't look off that,"
the vendor said amiably.
"And I'm betrothed to Hermione Granger, and Bellatrix Black, and Luna Lovegood, and, oh yes, Draco Malfoy too."
"Gonna be an interesting wedding," said the vendor.
Harry looked up from the newspaper and said in a pleasant voice,
"You know, I heard at first that Luna Lovegood was insane, and I wondered if she really was, or if she was just making stuff up and giggling to herself the whole time. Then when I read my second Quibbler headline, I decided that she couldn't be insane. I mean, it can't be easy to make this stuff up. You couldn't do it by accident. And now, do you know what I think? I think she must be mad after all. When ordinary people try to make stuff up, it doesn't come out like this. Something's got to go really wrong with the inside of your head before this is what comes out when you start making stuff up."
The vendor stared at Harry.
"Seriously," said Harry, "who reads this stuff?"
You, said the vendor.
Harry wandered off to read his newspaper. He didn't sit at the same nearby table he'd sat down at with Draco the first time he'd prepared to board this train. That seemed like tempting history to repeat itself. It wasn't just that his first week at Hogwarts had been, judging by the Quibbler, 54 years long. It was that, in Harry's humble opinion, his life didn't need any new threads of complexity. So, Harry found a small iron chair somewhere else, distant from the main crowd and the occasional muffled cracks of parents apparating in with their children, and sat down and read The Quibbler to see if it contained any suppressed news. And, besides the obvious craziness, heaven help them all if any of that was real, there was a good deal of snide romantic gossip, but nothing that would really be all that important if it were true. Harry was just reading about the Ministry's proposed marriage law to ban all marriages when...
"Harry Potter," said a silken voice that sent a shock of adrenaline jolting through Harry's blood.
Harry looked up.
"Lucius Malfoy,"
Harry said, his voice wary. Next time, he was going to do the smart thing and wait outside in the muggle part of King's Cross until 10:55 a.m. Lucius inclined his head courteously, sending his long white hair drifting over his shoulders. The man was still carrying that same cane, lacquered in black, with a silver snake's head for its handle, and something about his grip silently said, "This is a weapon of deadly power," not, "I'm feeble and leaning on this." His face was expressionless. Two men flanked him, their eyes continuously scanning, their wands already gripped low in their hands. The two of them moved like a single organism with four legs and four arms. The senior, Crab, and Goyle. And Harry thought he could guess which was which. But then it didn't really matter. They were merely Lucius's appendages, as certainly as if there'd been the two rightmost toes on his left foot.
"I apologize for disturbing you, Mr. Potter," said the smooth, silken voice. "But you have answered none of my owls, and this, I thought, might be my only opportunity to meet you."
"I have received none of your owls," Harry said calmly. "Dumbledore intercepts them, I presume, but I wouldn't have answered them if I had, except through Draco. For me to deal with you directly, without Draco's knowledge, would trespass on our friendship. Please go away. Oh, please go away."
The grey eyes glittered at him.
"Is that your pose, then?" said the senior Malfoy. "Well, I shall play along a little. What was your purpose in manoeuvring your good friend, my son, into a public alliance with that girl?"
"Oh," Harry said lightly, "that's obvious, right? Draco's working with Granger will make him realize that Muggleborns are human after all.
A thin trace of a smile moved over Lucius's lips.
"Yes, that does sound like one of Dumbledore's plans, which it is not."
"Indeed," said Harry. "It's part of my game with Draco, and no work of Dumbledore's. And that is all I'll say." "Let us dispense with games," said the senior Malfoy, the grey eyes suddenly hardening. "If my suspicions are true, you would hardly do Dumbledore's bidding in any case, Mr.
Potter."
There was a slight pause.
"So, you know,"
Harry said, his voice cold.
"Tell me, at which point exactly did you realize?" "When I read your response to Professor Quirrell's little speech," said the white-haired man, and chuckled grimly. "I was puzzled at first, for it seemed not in your own interest. It took me days to understand whose interest was being served. And then it all finally became clear. And it is also obvious that you are weak, in some ways, if not others." "Very clever of you," said Harry, still cold. "But perhaps you mistake my interests." "Perhaps I do." A hint of steel came into that silken voice. "Indeed, that is precisely what I fear. You are playing strange games with my son, to a purpose I cannot guess. That is not a friendly act, and you cannot but expect me to be concerned."
Lucius was leaning upon his cane with both hands now, and both those hands white, as his bodyguards had suddenly tensed. Some instinct within Harry claimed that it would be a very bad idea to show his fear, to let Lucius see that he could be intimidated. They were in a public train station anyway.
"I find it interesting," Harry said, putting steel into his own voice, "that you think I could benefit from doing Draco harm. But it is irrelevant, Lucius. He is my friend, and I do not betray my friends."
"What?"
whispered Lucius. His face showed sheer shock. Then,
"Company,"
said one of the minions, and Harry thought, from the voice, that it must be the senior crab. Lucius straightened and turned, then let out a hiss of disapproval. Neville was approaching, looking scared but determined, in tow behind a tall woman who didn't look scared at all.
"Madam Longbottom," Lucius said icily.
"Mr. Malfoy," returned the woman with equal ice. "Are you being an annoyance to our Harry Potter?"
The bark of laughter that came from Lucius seemed strangely bitter.
"Oh, I rather think not. Come to protect him from me, have you?"
The white-haired head shifted toward Neville.
"And this would be Mr. Potter's loyal lieutenant, the last scion of Longbottom, Neville, self-styled of Chaos. How strangely does the world turn. Sometimes I think it must all be mad."
Harry had no idea at all what to say to that, and Neville looked confused and frightened.
"I doubt that it is the world that is mad," said Madame Longbottom.
Her voice took on a gloating tone.
"You seem to be in a poor mood, Mr. Malfoy. Did the speech of our dear Professor Quirrell cost you a few allies?"
"It was clever enough slander of my abilities,"
Lucius said coldly,
"though only effective upon the fools who believe that I was truly a Death Eater."
"What?"
blurted Neville.
"I was under the Imperius, young man," said Lucius, now sounding tired. "The Dark Lord could have hardly begun recruiting among pureblood families without the support of House Malfoy.
I demurred, and he simply made sure of me. His own Death Eaters didn't know it until afterward, hence the false mark I bear. Though since I did not truly consent, it does not bind me. Some of the Death Eaters still believe I was foremost among their number, and for the peace of this nation, I let them believe it, to keep them controlled. But I was not such a fool as to support that ill-fated adventurer of my own choice.
"Ignore him,"
Madame Longbottom said, the instruction addressed to Harry as well as Neville.
"He must spend the rest of his life pretending, for fear of your testimony under Veritaserum,"
said with malicious satisfaction. Lucius turned his back on her dismissively and faced Harry again.
"Will you request this harridan to depart, Mr. Potter?"
"I think not," said Harry in a dry voice. "I prefer to deal with the part of House Malfoy that's my own age."
There was a long pause then. The grey eyes searched him.
"Of course," said Lucius slowly. "I do feel the fool now. This whole time, you were just pretending to have no idea what we were talking about."
Harry met the gaze and said nothing. Lucius raised his cane a few centimetres and struck it hard on the ground. The world vanished in a pale haze. All sounds went quiet. There was nothing in the universe but Harry and Lucius Malfoy and the snake-headed cane.
"My son is my heart," said the senior Malfoy. "The last worthwhile thing I have left in this world. And this I say to you in a spirit of friendship. If he were to come to harm, I would give my life over to vengeance. But so long as my son does not come to harm, I wish you the best of luck in your endeavours. And as you have asked nothing more of me, I will ask nothing more of you."
Then the pale haze vanished, showing an outraged Madame Longbottom being blocked from moving forward by the senior crab. Her wand was in her hand now.
"How dare you!"
she hissed. Lucius's dark robe swirled around him and his white hair as he turned to the senior Goyle.
"We return to Malfoy Manor."
There were three pops of apparition, and they were gone. A silence followed.
"Dear heavens!"
said Madame Longbottom.
"What was that about?"
Harry shrugged helplessly. Then he looked at Neville. There was sweat on Neville's forehead.
"Thank you very much, Neville," said Harry. "Your help was greatly appreciated, Neville. And now, Neville, I think you should sit down."
"Yes, General,"
said Neville, and instead of coming over to one of the other chairs near Harry, he semi-collapsed into a sitting position on the pavement.
"You have wrought many changes in my grandson,"
said Madame Longbottom.
"I approve of some, but not others."
"Send me a list of which is which," said Harry. "I'll see what I can do."
Neville groaned but said nothing. Madame Longbottom gave a chuckle.
"I shall, young man. Thank you."
Her voice lowered.
"Mr. Potter, The speech given by Professor Quirrell is something our nation has long needed to hear. I cannot say as much of your comment on it. I'll take your opinion under advisement, Harry said mildly. I dearly hope that you do, said Madame Longbottom, and turned back to her grandson. Do I still need to... It's okay for you to go, Grandma, said Neville. I'll be fine on my own this time. Now that I approve of, she said, and popped and vanished like a soap bubble.
The two boys sat quietly for a moment. Neville spoke first, his voice wary.
You're gonna try to fix all the changes she approves of, right? Not all of them, Harry said innocently. I just want to make sure I'm not corrupting you.
Draco looked very worried. His head kept darting around, despite the fact that Draco had insisted on them going down into Harry's trunk and using a true quieting charm and not just the sound-blurring barrier.
"What did you say to Farah?"
blurted Draco the moment the quieting charm went up and the sounds of Platform 9 3/4 vanished.
Look, can you tell me what he said to you before he dropped you off?
Said Harry.
That I should tell him right away if you seemed to be threatening me,
said Draco.
That I should tell him right away if there was anything I was doing that could pose a threat to you. Father thinks you're dangerous, Harry. Whatever you said to him today, it scared him. It's not a good idea to scare Father.
Oh, hell.
What did you talk about?
Demanded Draco. Harry leaned back warily in the small folding chair that sat at the bottom of his trunk's cavern.
You know, Draco, just as the fundamental question of rationality is, what do I think I know, and how do I think I know it, there's also a cardinal sin, a way of thinking that's the opposite of that, like the ancient Greek philosophers. They had no clue what was going on, so they'd go around saying things like, all is water, or all is fire, and they never asked themselves, wait a minute, even if everything is water, how could I possibly know that? They didn't ask themselves if they had evidence which discriminated that possibility from all the other possibilities you could imagine. Evidence they'd be very unlikely to encounter if the theory wasn't true.
Harry!
Draco said, his voice strained.
What did you talk about with Father?
I don't know, actually, said Harry. So, it's very important that I not just make stuff up.
Harry had never heard Draco shriek in horror in quite that high a pitch before. Chapter 39 Pretending to be Wise Part 1 Whistle, tick, bzzz, ding, glorp, plop, splat, chime, toot, puff, tinkle, blah, 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 beep, doom, whoosh, spiff-fuddle. Professor Flitwick had silently passed Harry a folded parchment during charms class that Monday, and the note had said that Harry was to visit the headmaster at his convenience, and in such fashion that no one else would notice, especially not Draco Malfoy or Professor Quirrell. His one-time password for the gargoyle would be Squeamish Ossifrage. This had been accompanied by a remarkably artistic ink drawing of Professor Flitwick staring at him sternly, the eyes of which occasionally blinked, and, at the bottom of the note, underlined three times, was the phrase, "Don't get into trouble." And so, Harry had finished up Transfiguration class and studied with Hermione, and eaten dinner, and spoken with his lieutenants, and finally, when the clock struck 9, turned himself invisible and dropped back to 6 p.m. and warily trudged off toward the gargoyle, the turning spiral stairs, the wooden door, the room full of little fiddly things, and the silver-bearded figure of the headmaster. This time, Dumbledore looked quite serious, the customary smile absent, and he was dressed in pyjamas of a darker and more sober purple than usual.
"Thank you for coming, Harry," said the headmaster.
The old wizard rose from his throne, began to slowly pace through the room and find the strange devices.
"First, do you have with you the notes of yesterday's encounter with Lucius Malfoy?"
"Notes?"
blurted Harry.
"Surely you wrote it down," said the old wizard, and his voice trailed off.
Harry felt rather embarrassed. "Yes, if you'd just fumbled through a mysterious conversation full of significant hints you didn't understand, the bloody obvious thing to do would be to write it all down immediately afterward, before the memory faded, so you could try to figure it out later."
"All right," said the headmaster. "From memory, then."
Harry sheepishly recited as best he could, and got almost halfway through before he realized that it wasn't smart to just go around telling the possibly crazy headmaster everything, at least not without thinking about it first. But then Lucius was definitely a bad guy, and Dumbledore's opponent, so it probably was a good idea to tell him, and Harry had already started talking, and it was too late to try and calculate things out now. Harry finished his recollections honestly. Dumbledore's face had grown more remote as Harry went on, and at the end there was a look of ancientness about him and sternness in the air.
"Well," said Dumbledore, "I suggest you take the best of care that the heir of Malfoy does not come to harm, then. And I will do the same."
The headmaster was frowning, his fingers drumming soundlessly through the inky black surface of a plate inscribed with the word Lalil.
"And I think it would be most extremely wise for you to avoid all interaction with Lord Malfoy henceforth."
"Did you intercept owls from him to me?"
said Harry. The headmaster gazed at Harry for a long moment, then reluctantly nodded. For some reason, Harry wasn't feeling as outraged as he should have been. Maybe it was just that Harry was finding it very easy to sympathize with the headmaster's point of view right now. Even Harry could understand why Dumbledore wouldn't want him to interact with Lucius Malfoy. It didn't seem like an evil deed. Not like the headmaster blackmailing Zabini, for which they had only Zabini's word, and Zabini was wildly untrustworthy. In fact, it was hard to see why Zabini wouldn't just tell the story that got him the most sympathy from Professor Quirrell.
"How about if, instead of protesting, I say that I understand your point of view?"
said Harry,
And you go on intercepting my owls, but you tell me who from.
I have intercepted a great many owls to you, I am afraid,
Dumbledore said soberly.
You are a celebrity, Harry, and you would receive dozens of letters a day, some from far outside this country. Did I not turn them back?
That,
Harry said, now starting to feel a bit of indignation,
seems like going a little too far.
Many of those letters,
the old wizard said quietly,
will be asking you for things you cannot give. I have not read them, of course, only turned them back to their senders undelivered. But I know, for I receive them too, and you are too young, Harry, to have your heart broken 6 times before breakfast each morning.
Harry looked down at his shoes. He should insist on reading the letters and judging for himself, but there was a small voice of common sense inside him, and it was screaming very loudly right now.
Thank you,
Harry muttered.
The other reason I asked you here,
said the old wizard,
was that I wished to consult your unique genius.
Transfiguration?
Said Harry, surprised and flattered.
No, not that unique genius, said Dumbledore. Tell me, Harry, what evil could you accomplish if a Dementor were allowed onto the grounds of Hogwarts?
It developed that Professor Quirrell had asked, or rather demanded, that his students test their skills against an actual Dementor after they learned the words and gestures to the Patronus charm.
Professor Quirrell is unable to cast the Patronus charm himself,
said Dumbledore as he paced slowly through the devices,
which is never a good sign. But then he volunteered that fact to me in the course of demanding that outside instructors be brought in to teach the Patronus charm to every student who wished to learn. He offered to pay the expense himself, if I would not. This impressed me greatly, but now he insists on bringing in a Dementor.
Headmaster,
Harry said quietly,
Professor Quirrell believes very strongly in live fire tests under realistic combat conditions. Wanting to bring an actual Dementor is completely in character for him.
Now the headmaster was giving Harry a strange look.
In character,
said the old wizard.
I mean,
said Harry,
it's entirely consistent with the way Professor Quirrell usually acts.
Harry trailed off. Why had he put it that way? The headmaster nodded.
So, you have the same sense I do, that it is an excuse, a very reasonable excuse, to be sure, more so than you may realize. Often, wizards seemingly unable to cast a Patronus charm will succeed in the presence of an actual Dementor, going from not a single flicker of light to a full corporeal Patronus. Why this should be, no one knows, but it is so.
Harry frowned.
Then I really don't see why you're suspicious.
The headmaster spread his hands as though in helplessness.
Harry, the defense professor has asked me to pass the darkest of all creatures through the gates of Hogwarts. I must be suspicious.
The headmaster sighed.
And yet, the Dementor will be guarded, warded, in a mighty cage. I will be there myself to watch it at all times. I cannot think of what ill could be done. But perhaps I am merely unable to see it. And so I am asking you.
Harry stared at the headmaster with his mouth open. He was so shocked he couldn't even feel flattered.
Me?
Said Harry.
Yes,
said Dumbledore, smiling slightly.
I try my best to anticipate my foes, to encompass their wicked minds, and predict their evil thoughts. But I would never have imagined sharpening a Hufflepuff's bones into weapons.
Was Harry ever going to live that down?
Headmaster,
Harry said wearily.
I know it doesn't sound good, but in all seriousness, I'm not evil. I'm just very creative.
I did not say that you were evil,
Dumbledore said seriously.
There are those who say that to comprehend evil is to become evil, but they are merely pretending to be wise. Rather, it is evil which does not know love, and dares not imagine love, and cannot ever understand love without ceasing to be evil. And I suspect that you can imagine your way into the minds of dark wizards better than I ever could, while still knowing love yourself. So, Harry,
the headmaster's eyes were intent.
If you stood in Professor Quirrell's shoes, what misdeeds could you accomplish after you tricked me into allowing a Dementor onto the grounds of Hogwarts?
Hold on,
said Harry, and in something of a daze, trudged over to the chair in front of the headmaster's desk, and sat down. It was a large and comfortable chair this time, not a wooden stool, and Harry could feel himself enveloped as he sank into it. Dumbledore was asking him to outwit Professor Quirrell. Point one, Harry was rather fonder of Professor Quirrell than of Dumbledore. Point two, the hypothesis was that the defense professor was planning to do something evil, and in that subjunctive case, Harry ought to be helping the headmaster prevent it. Point three.
Headmaster, Harry said, if Professor Quirrell is up to something, I'm not sure I can outwit him. He's got a lot more experience than I do.
The old wizard shook his head, somehow managing to appear very solemn, despite his smile.
You underestimate yourself.
That was the first time anyone had ever said that to Harry.
I remember, the old wizard continued, a young man in this very office, cold and controlled, as he faced down the head of House Slytherin, blackmailing his own headmaster to protect his classmates. And I believe that young man is more cunning than Professor Quirrell, more cunning than Lucius Malfoy, that he will grow to be the equal of Voldemort himself. It is he who I wish to consult.
Harry suppressed the chill that went through him at the name, frowned thoughtfully at the headmaster.
How much does he know?
The headmaster had seen Harry in the grip of his mysterious dark side, as deep as Harry had ever sunk into it. Harry still remembered what it had been to watch, invisibly time-turned, as his past self faced down the older Slytherins, the boy with the scar on his forehead who didn't act like the others. Of course the headmaster would have noticed something odd about the boy in his office. And Dumbledore had concluded that his pet hero had cunning to match his destined foe, the Dark Lord. Which wasn't asking for very much, considering that the Dark Lord had put a clearly visible dark mark on all of his servants' left arms, and that it slaughtered the entire monastery that taught the martial art it wanted to learn. Enough cunning to match Professor Quirrell would be a whole different order of problem. But it was also clear that the headmaster wouldn't be satisfied until Harry went all cold and darkish, and came up with some sort of answer that sounded impressively cunning, which had better not actually get in the way of Professor Quirrell's teaching defense. And, of course, Harry would go over to his dark side and think it through from that direction, just to be honest, and just in case.
Tell me, Harry said, everything about how the Dementor is to be brought in and how it is to be guarded.
Dumbledore's eyebrows rose for a moment, and then the old wizard began to speak. The Dementor would be transported to the grounds of Hogwarts by an Aura trio, all three personally known to the headmaster, and all three able to cast a corporeal Patronus charm. They would be met at the edge of the grounds by Dumbledore, who would pass the Dementor through the Hogwarts wards. Harry asked if the pass was permanent or temporary, whether someone could just bring in the same Dementor again the next day. The pass was temporary, replied the headmaster with an approving nod, and the explanation went on. The Dementor would be in a cage of solid titanium bars, not transfigured but true forged. In time, a Dementor's presence would corrode that metal to dust, but not in a single day. Students awaiting their turn would stay well back of the Dementor, behind two corporeal Patronuses maintained by two of the three Auras at any given time. Dumbledore would wait by the Dementor's cage with his Patronus. A single student would approach the Dementor, and Dumbledore would dispel his Patronus. And the student would attempt to cast their own Patronus charm. And if they failed, Dumbledore would restore his Patronus before the student could suffer any permanent damage. Past dueling champion Professor Flitwick would also be present while there were students near, just to add safety margin.
"Why just you waiting by the Dementor?" said Harry. "I mean, shouldn't it be you plus an aura?"
The headmaster shook his head.
"They could not withstand the repeated exposure to the Dementor each time I dispel my Patronus."
And if Dumbledore's Patronus did fail for some reason, while one of the students was still near the Dementor, the third aura would cast another corporeal Patronus and send it to shield the student. Harry poked and prodded, but he couldn't see a flaw in the security. So, Harry took a deep breath, sank further into the chair, closed his eyes, and remembered.
"And that will be 5 points. No, let us make it an even 10 points from Ravenclaw for back chat."
The cold came more slowly now, more reluctantly. Harry hadn't been calling much on his dark side lately. Harry had to run through that entire session in potions in his mind before his blood chilled into something approaching deadly crystalline clarity. And then he thought of the Dementor. And it was obvious.
"The Dementor is a distraction," Harry said,
the coldness clear in his voice, since that was what Dumbledore wanted and expected.
"A large, salient threat, but in the end, straightforward and easy to defend against. So, while all your attention is focused on the Dementor, the real plot will be happening elsewhere."
Dumbledore stared at Harry for a moment, and then gave a slow nod.
"Yes," said the headmaster. "And I do believe I know what it might be a distraction from, if Professor Quirrell means ill. Thank you, Harry."
The headmaster was still staring at Harry, a strange look in those ancient eyes.
"What?"
said Harry with a tinge of annoyance, the cold still lingering in his blood.
"I have another question for that young man," said the headmaster. "It is something I have long wondered to myself, yet been unable to comprehend. Why?"
There was a tinge of pain in his voice.
"Why would anyone deliberately make himself a monster? Why do evil for the sake of evil? Why, Voldemort?"
Harry stared at the headmaster in surprise.
"How would I know?" said Harry. "I'm supposed to magically understand the Dark Lord because I'm the hero or something."
"Yes," said Dumbledore. "My own great foe was Grindelwald, and him I understood very well indeed. Grindelwald was my dark mirror, the man I could so easily have been had I given in to the temptation to believe that I was a good person, and therefore always in the right. For the greater good, that was his slogan, and he truly believed it himself, even as he tore at all Europe like a wounded animal. And him I defeated in the end. But then, after him came Voldemort, to destroy everything I had protected in Britain."
The hurt was plain now in Dumbledore's voice, exposed upon his face.
"He committed acts worse by far than Grindelwald's worst. Horror for the sake of horror. I
sacrificed everything only to hold him back. And I still don't understand why. Why, Harry? Why did he do it? He was never my destined foe, but yours. So, if you have any guesses at all, Harry, please tell me why.
Harry stared down at his hands. The truth was that Harry hadn't read up on the Dark Lord yet, and right now he hadn't the tiniest clue. And somehow, that didn't seem like an answer the headmaster wanted to hear.
Too many dark rituals, maybe? In the beginning, he thought he'd do just one, but it sacrificed part of his good side, and that made him less reluctant to perform other dark rituals, so he did more and more rituals in a positive feedback cycle until he ended up as a tremendously powerful monster.
No!
Now the headmaster's voice was agonized.
I can't believe that, Harry. There has to be something more to it than just that.
Why should there be?
Thought Harry, but he didn't say it, because it was clear that the headmaster thought the universe was a story and had a plot, and that huge tragedies weren't always to happen except for equally huge, significant reasons.
I'm sorry, Headmaster. The Dark Lord doesn't seem like much of a dark mirror to me. Not at all. There isn't anything I find even the tiniest bit tempting about nailing the skins of Yermy Wibble's family to a newsroom wall.
Have you no wisdom to share?
Said Dumbledore. There was pleading in the old wizard's voice, almost begging.
Evil happens,
thought Harry.
It doesn't mean anything or teach us anything, except not to be evil. The Dark Lord was probably just a selfish bastard who didn't care who he hurt, or an idiot who made stupidly avoidable mistakes that snowballed. There's no destiny behind the ills of this world. If Hitler had been allowed into architecture school like he wanted, the whole history of Europe would have been different. If we lived in the sort of universe where horrible things were only allowed to happen for good reasons, they just wouldn't happen in the first place.
And none of that, obviously, was what the headmaster wanted to hear. The old wizard was still looking at Harry from over a fiddly thing, like a frozen puff of smoke, a painful desperation in those ancient, waiting eyes. Well, sounding wise wasn't difficult. It was a lot easier than being intelligent, actually, since you didn't have to say anything surprising or come up with any new insights. You just let your brain's pattern-matching software complete the cliché, using whatever deep wisdom you'd stored previously.
Headmaster, Harry said solemnly, I would rather not define myself by my enemies.
Somehow, even in the midst of all the whirring and ticking, there was a kind of silence. That had come out a bit more deeply wise than Harry had intended.
You may be very wise, Harry,
the headmaster said slowly.
I do wish that I could have been defined by my friends.
The pain in his voice had grown deeper. Harry's mind searched hastily for something else deeply wise to say that would soften the unintended force of the blow.
Or perhaps,
Harry said more softly.
"It is the foe that makes the Gryffindor, as it is the friend that makes the Hufflepuff, and the ambition that makes the Slytherin. I do know that it is always, in every generation, the puzzle that makes the scientist."
"It is a dreadful fate to which you condemn my house, Harry,"
said the headmaster. The pain was still in his voice.
"For now that you remark on it, I do think that I was very much made by my enemies."
Harry stared at his own hands, where they lay in his lap. Maybe he should just shut up while he was ahead.
"But you have answered my question,"
said Dumbledore more softly, as though to himself.
"I should have realized that would be a Slytherin's key. For his ambition, all for the sake of his ambition. And that I know, though not why."
For a time, Dumbledore stared off into nothingness. Then he straightened, and his eyes seemed to focus on Harry again.
"And you, Harry," said the headmaster, "you name yourself a scientist?"
"You don't like science," said Harry a little wearily. He'd hoped Dumbledore would be fonder of Muggle things.
"I suppose it is useful to those without wands," said Dumbledore, frowning. "But it seems a strange thing by which to define yourself. Is science as important as love, as kindness, as friendship? Is it science that makes you fond of Minerva McGonagall? Is it science that makes you care for Hermione Granger? Will it be science to which you turn when you try to kindle warmth in Draco Malfoy's heart?"
"You know, the sad thing is, you probably think you just uttered some kind of incredibly wise knockdown argument."
Now, how to phrase the rejoinder in such fashion that it also sounded incredibly wise?
"You are not a Ravenclaw,"
Harry said with calm dignity.
"And so it might not have occurred to you that to respect the truth and seek it all the days of your life could also be an act of grace."
The headmaster's eyebrows rose up, and then he sighed.
"How did you become so wise, so young?"
The old wizard sounded sad as he said it.
"Perhaps it will prove valuable to you."
"Only for impressing ancient wizards who are overly impressed with themselves," thought Harry.
He was actually a bit disappointed by Dumbledore's credulity. It wasn't that Harry had lied, but Dumbledore seemed far too impressed with Harry's ability to phrase things so that they sounded profound, instead of putting them into plain English like Richard Feynman had done with his wisdom.
"Love is more important than wisdom," said Harry,
just to test the limits of Dumbledore's tolerance for blindingly obvious clichés completed by sheer pattern matching without any sort of detailed analysis. The headmaster nodded gravely and said,
"Indeed."
Harry stood up out of the chair and stretched his arms.
"Well, I'd better go off and love something, then. That's bound to help me defeat the Dark Lord, and next time you ask me for advice, I'll just give you a hug."
"This day you have helped me much, Harry," said the headmaster. "And so there's one last thing I would ask that young man."
"Great."
"Tell me, Harry,"
said the headmaster, and now his voice sounded simply puzzled, though there was still a hint of pain in his eyes.
"Why do dark wizards fear death so greatly?"
Said Harry. Sorry, I've got to back the dark wizards on that one."
Whoosh, hiss, chime, glorp, boop, bubble. "What?" said Dumbledore.
"Death is bad,"
said Harry, discarding wisdom for the sake of clear communication.
"Very bad. Extremely bad. Being scared of death is like being scared of a great big monster with poisonous fangs. It actually makes a great deal of sense and does not, in fact, indicate that you have a psychological problem."
The headmaster was staring at him as though he'd just turned into a cat.
"Okay," said Harry. "Let me put it this way. Do you want to die? Because if so, there's this muggle thing called a suicide prevention hotline."
"When it is time,"
the old wizard said quietly.
"Not before. I would never seek to hasten the day, nor seek to refuse it when it comes."
Harry was frowning sternly.
"That doesn't sound like you have a very strong will to live, headmaster."
"Harry."
The old wizard's voice was starting to sound a little helpless, and he had paced to a spot where his silver beard, unnoticed, had drifted into a crystalline glass goldfish bowl, and was slowly taking on a greenish tinge that crept up the hairs.
"I think I may have not made myself clear. Dark wizards are not eager to live. They fear death. They do not reach up toward the sun's light, but flee the coming of night into infinitely darker caverns of their own making, without moon or stars. It is not life they desire, but immortality, and they are so driven to grasp at it that they will sacrifice their very souls. Do you want to live forever, Harry?"
"Yes," said Harry. "I want to live one more day. Tomorrow I will still want to live one more day. Therefore, I want to live forever. Proof by induction on the positive integers. If you don't want to die, it means you want to live forever. If you don't want to live forever, it means you want to die. You've got to do one or the other. I'm not getting through here, am I?"
The two cultures stared at each other across a vast gap of incommensurability.
"I have lived 110 years,
the old wizard said quietly, taking his beard out of the bowl and jiggling it to shake out the colour.
"I have seen and done a great many things, too many of which I wish I had never seen or done. And yet I do not regret being alive, for watching my students grow is a joy that has not begun to wear on me. But I would not wish to live so long that it does. What would you do with eternity, Harry?"
Harry took a deep breath.
"Meet all the interesting people in the world, read all the good books and then write something even better. Celebrate my first grandchild's 10th birthday party on the moon. Celebrate my first great-great-great-grandchild's 100th birthday party around the rings of Saturn. Learn the deepest and final rules of nature. Understand the nature of consciousness. Find out why anything exists in the first place. Visit other stars, discover aliens, create aliens, rendezvous with everyone for a party on the other side of the Milky Way once we've explored the whole thing, meet up with everyone else who was born on old Earth to watch the sun finally go out, and I used to worry about finding a way to escape this universe before it ran out of negentropy, but I'm a lot more hopeful now that I've discovered the so-called laws of physics are just optional guidelines.
I did not understand much of that, said Dumbledore. But I must ask if these are things that you truly desire so desperately, or if you only imagine them so as to imagine not being tired as you run and run from death.
Life's not a finite list of things that you check off before you're allowed to die, Harry said firmly. It's life. You just go on living it. If I'm not doing those things, it'll be because I found something better.
Dumbledore sighed. His fingers drummed on a clock. As they touched it, the numerals changed to an indecipherable script, and the hands briefly appeared in different positions.
In the unlikely event that I am permitted to tarry until 150, said the old wizard, I do not think I would mind. But 200 years would be entirely too much of a good thing.
Yes, well, Harry said, his voice a little dry as he thought of his mum and dad and their allotted span if Harry didn't do something about it. I suspect, Headmaster, that if you came from a culture where people were accustomed to living 400 years, that dying at 200 would seem just as tragically premature as dying at, say, 80.
Harry's voice went hard on that last word.
Perhaps, the old wizard said peacefully. I would not wish to die before my friends, nor live on after they had all gone. The hardest time is when those you loved the most have gone on before you, and yet others still live, for whose sake you must stay.
Dumbledore's eyes were fixed on Harry and growing sad.
Do not mourn me too greatly, Harry. When my time comes, I will be with those I have long missed on our next great adventure.
Oh, Harry said in sudden realization, you believe in an afterlife. I got the impression wizards didn't have religion.
Toot. Beep. Thud.
How can you not believe it?
Said the headmaster, looking completely flabbergasted.
Harry, you're a wizard. You've seen ghosts.
Ghosts? Harry said, his voice flat. You mean those things like portraits, stored memories and behaviours with no awareness or life, accidentally impressed into the surrounding material by the burst of magic that accompanies the violent death of a wizard?
I've heard that theory,
said the headmaster, his voice growing sharp.
Repeated by wizards who mistake cynicism for wisdom, who think that to look down upon others is to elevate themselves. It is one of the silliest ideas I have heard in 110 years. Yes, ghosts do not learn or grow, because that is not where they belong.
Souls are meant to move on. There is no life remaining for them here. And if not ghosts, then what of the veil? What of the resurrection stone?
All right,
Harry said, trying to keep his voice calm.
I'll hear out your evidence, because that's what a scientist does. But first, Headmaster, let me tell you a little story.
Harry's voice was trembling.
You know, when I got here, when I got off the train from King's Cross, I don't mean yesterday, but back in September, when I got off the train then, Headmaster, I'd never seen a ghost. I wasn't expecting ghosts. So, when I saw them, Headmaster, I did something really dumb. I jumped to conclusions. I thought there was an afterlife. I thought no one had ever really died. I thought that everyone the human species had ever lost was really fine after all. I thought that wizards could talk to people who'd passed on, that it just took the right spell to summon them, that wizards could do that. I thought I could meet my parents, who died for me, and tell them that I'd heard about their sacrifice and that I'd begun to call them my mother and father.
Harry,
whispered Dumbledore. Water glittered in the old wizard's eyes. He took a step closer across the office.
And then,
spat Harry, the fury coming fully into his voice, the cold rage at the universe for being like that and at himself for being so stupid.
I asked Hermione, and she said that they were just after images, burned into the stone of the castle by the death of a wizard, like the silhouettes left on the walls of Hiroshima. And I should have known. I should have known, without even having to ask. I shouldn't have believed it, even for all of 30 seconds. Because if people had souls, there wouldn't be any such thing as brain damage. If your soul could go on speaking after your whole brain was gone, how could damage to the left cerebral hemisphere take away your ability to talk? And Professor McGonagall, when she told me about how my parents had died, she didn't act like they'd just gone away on a long trip to another country, like they'd emigrated to Australia back in the days of sailing ships, which is the way people would act if they actually knew that death wasn't just going somewhere else. If they had hard evidence for an afterlife, instead of making stuff up to console themselves, it would change everything. It wouldn't matter that everyone had lost someone in the war. It would be a little sad, but not horrible. And I'd already seen that people in the wizarding world didn't act like that. So, I should have known better. And that was when I knew that my parents were really dead, and gone forever and ever. That there wasn't anything left of them. That I'd never get a chance to meet them, And the other children thought I was crying because I was scared of ghosts.
The old wizard's face was horrified. He opened his mouth to speak.
So, tell me, Headmaster, tell me about the evidence. But don't you dare exaggerate a single tiny bit of it. Because if you give me false hope again, and I find out later that you lied or stretched things just a little, I won't ever forgive you for it. What's the veil?
Harry reached up and wiped at his cheeks, while the glass things of the office stopped vibrating from his last shriek.
The veil,
said the old wizard, with only a slight tremble in his voice,
is a great stone archway kept in the Department of Mysteries, a gateway to the land of the dead.
"And how does anyone know that?" said Harry. "Don't tell me what you believe. Tell me what you've seen."
The physical manifestation of the barrier between worlds was a great stone archway, old and tall and coming to a sharp point, with a tattered black veil like the surface of a pool of water, stretched between the stones, rippling, always, from the constant and one-way passage of the souls. If you stood by the veil, you could hear the voices of the dead calling, always calling in whispers barely on the wrong side of comprehension, growing louder and more numerous if you stayed and tried to hear, as if they tried to communicate. And if you listened too long, you would go to meet them. And in the moment you touched the veil, you would be sucked through, and never be heard from again.
"That doesn't even sound like an interesting fraud," Harry said, his voice calmer now that there was nothing there to make him hope, or make him angry for having hopes dashed.
"Someone built a stone archway, made a little black rippling surface between it that vanished anything it touched, and enchanted it to whisper to people and hypnotize them."
"Harry,"
the headmaster said, starting to look rather worried.
"I can tell you the truth, but if you refuse to hear it..."
"Also not interesting. What's the resurrection stone?"
"I would not tell you,"
the headmaster said slowly,
"save that I fear what this disbelief may do to you. So listen, then, Harry. Please listen."
The Resurrection Stone was one of the three legendary Deathly Hallows, akin to Harry's cloak. The Resurrection Stone could call souls back from the dead, bring them back into the world of the living, though not as they were. Cadmus Peverell used the stone to call back his lost beloved from the dead, but her heart stayed with the dead, and not in the world of the living. And in time it drove him mad, and he killed himself to be truly with her once more. In all politeness, Harry raised his hand.
"Yes,"
the headmaster said reluctantly.
"The obvious test to see if the Resurrection Stone is really calling back the dead, or just projecting an image from the user's mind, is to ask a question whose answer you don't know, but the dead person would, and that can be definitely verified in this world. For example, call back..."
Then Harry paused, because this time he'd managed to think it through one step ahead of his tongue, fast enough to not say the first name and test that had sprung to mind.
"Your dead wife, and ask her where she left her lost earring, or something like that,"
Harry finished.
"Did anyone do any tests like that?"
"The Resurrection Stone has been lost for centuries, Harry,"
the headmaster said quietly. Harry shrugged.
"Well, I'm a scientist, and I'm always willing to be convinced. If you really believe the Resurrection Stone calls back the dead, then you must believe a test like that will succeed, right? So, do you know anything about where to find the Resurrection Stone? I got one Deathly Hallow already under highly mysterious circumstances, and, well, we both know how the rhythm of the world works on that sort of thing."
Dumbledore stared at Harry. Harry gazed equably back at the headmaster. The old wizard passed a hand across his forehead and muttered,
"This is madness."
Somehow, Harry managed to stop himself from laughing. And Dumbledore told Harry to draw forth the Cloak of Invisibility from his pouch. At the headmaster's direction, Harry stared at the inside and back of the hood until he saw it, faintly drawn against the silvery mesh in faded scarlet like dried blood, the symbol of the Deathly Hallows. A triangle, with a circle drawn inside, and a line dividing them both.
"Thank you," Harry said politely. "I shall be sure to keep an eye out for a stone so marked. Do you have any other evidence?"
Dumbledore appeared to be fighting a struggle within himself.
"Harry,"
the old wizard said, his voice rising.
"This is a dangerous road you are walking. I am not sure I do the right thing by saying this, but I must wrench you from this way. Harry, how could Voldemort have survived the death of his body if he did not have a soul?"
And that was when Harry realized that there was exactly one person who'd originally told Professor McGonagall that the Dark Lord was still alive in the first place. And it was the crazy headmaster of their madhouse of a school, who thought the world ran on clichés.
"Good question,"
Harry said after some internal debate about how to proceed.
"Maybe he found some way of duplicating the power of the Resurrection Stone, only he loaded it in advance with a complete copy of his brain state.